This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Capital One Venture X Card. Earn unlimited 2X miles on everything you buy. Plus, get access to a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
From NPR Music and All Songs Considered, I'm Robin Hilton. Back in 1972, Carlos Santana released the album Caravanserai. A lot of fans were really surprised by it and even turned off by the album because it leaned so heavily into jazz fusion. It was an entirely new sound for Santana. It also signaled a kind of spiritual awakening that's become a through line for Santana's music ever since. As we mark the 50th anniversary of Caravanserai, our friends at NPR's Alt Latino, Felix Contreras and Ana Maria Sayer, they sat down with Santana to talk with him about the album Caravanserai and how pivotal it became in his career. Here's Ana Maria.
Is talking to Santana like kind of one of your top dream interviews?
You know, it's difficult because I know too much. You know?
Like, how do you not sound like a stalker, know too much?
Yeah, exactly. Or how to make the conversation accessible to everybody who doesn't know as much as, you know, diehard Santana fans do.
Right.
That's a little difficult because there's, you know, he's a complex guy and there's a long career. And it's sort of like Duke Ellington where you can, like, have different aspects of his career based on what year. Duke Ellington, Miles Davis, all of those people. In fact, some of the people that he actually admires, it's that way. You got to think about where you want to dip your toe in.
It was really cool, I think, to get that sense from you. Because I feel like up until now, a lot of the people we've interviewed have very much been like a lot more in my lane or like people I'm a little more nervous about interviewing. And you were like, you were total kind of fangirl about this one. I was like, you would be like nodding along. You're like, yeah, everything he's saying. And I was like, totally. But also like, what exactly does this mean?
You know, this is like, you know, almost 50 years of hearing him talk like that. And eventually, as a fan, it was lost on me until I myself started doing more research and work on mindfulness and things like that. And then it all started to make sense. Like, oh, now I hear what he's saying.
So it's like you're getting to know him in a whole new light, too, even as someone who's a huge fan.
You don't need that to understand the music, although it helps, but to understand the language. You know, people who are deep in thought like that, that's how they talk. Mm-hmm. They talk at a different level. And I love the fact that you came to it from a position of wanting to know more. That gave him an opportunity to be teacher in a way that's never part of the conversation in the three or four times that we've interviewed him on the show.
Yeah, I really am one of the uninitiated. But I gotta say, I was all up in it afterwards. I was like Caravanserai on repeat, like in my feels, like so meditative. Like, wow, I'm just like reaching this other plane of mindfulness.
And it's hard to separate that from the fact that, you know, he's an icon, well over 50 years performing. He's played on every continent. He's so respected in the music world. Generally, he's respected within Latino communities, plural, for all that he represents for so long. There's that part of him that's like almost awe-inspiring, like, wow, this is a big guy, right? I mean, he knew Hendrix, he knew Miles Davis. I mean, that's a connection to history. But then there's the other part of him that we talked to him about.
That is a unique gift, to keep being able to reinvent and to keep being able to bring something new and quite revolutionary, honestly, to the table is really, wow, I guess that's what makes him one of the greats, right?
I think so. And I think that's why going back to this record in 1972, the 50th anniversary of Caravanserai, which was the launch of his spiritual path musically and personally, it took a really big career risk to do this. He lost a lot of fans in the short run, but eventually it contributed to his longevity. You're listening to Alt Latino from NPR Music. I'm Felix Contreras.
And I'm Ana Maria Sayer. Let the chisme begin.
You know, And when I told a friend of mine that we were going to have a conversation with you about your spiritual journey, she told me that back in the 70s here in D.C., when you were performing under the name Devadip Carlos Santana, she and two friends of hers snuck backstage after the show somehow and ended up meeting you. And she said that you guys, you sat cross-legged on the floor and talked about things like higher consciousness. And she said that it made such an impact on her that she remembered it like it was yesterday. We want to talk to you about that journey this week on Alt Latino. But let's go back even further. Where was Carlos Santana's spirit in March of 1972?
I was probably creating the music from Caravanserai with Michael Shreve. We were probably discussing the flow, the sequence, and the making of it. You could feel that Greg Riley and Neil wanted to do their own thing, which is like Journey. And we wanted to discover more things about Miles Davis and Weather Report and McCoy Tyner and Alice Coltrane and John McLaughlin. In 1972, we were in the process of giving birth to a whole new side of Santana. It was new to us. A lot of people were scratching their heads because they thought I lost my mind, you know. Like, what are you doing this? Because, you know, we want you to play more Abraxas and more, you know. And I said, well, we already did that, you know. And I need to expand, ascend, transcend, extend, and ascend, you know. But they didn't understand that at that time. They just wanted what they wanted. And I says, well, you know, I wasn't born to please you. I was born to please my spirit and my soul and my light. And this is something that I said to my mom when I first started. I says, you know, Mom, someday I'm going to play my own music and people are going to pay me to play what I want to play. And she scratched her head and she goes, pobrecito de mi hijo, you know, he lost his mind. You've been smoking too much weed, you know. And I'm like, thanks for the encouraging words, Mom. You know, I says, but I'm going to play what I want to play. And if people like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. I want it to be so that I play life and my menu is no menu. You know, mm-hmm. I'm going to cook what I want to cook, and I hope you're hungry because it's going to be delicious. But if you just want me to be like Taco Bell or McDonald's, that ain't going to happen. You know, I'm not going to be a one-trick pony. And so a lot of people were confused, almost angry, because I wasn't giving them another Abraxas or another third album or a first album. They're like, well, there's not even a single. I says, okay, I agree with you. So? But I'm growing as a person. I can look myself in the mirror, and I'm happy with what I see and who I am.
I'm curious, like, what was stirring inside of you in your heart, in your soul, at that moment that caused you to pivot? You were like, fuck it, I don't care what the label says, what anyone says. You've had all this success, and then all of a sudden you're like, I'm going to do what I want to do. What happened inside of you to change that?
I think they called it my first career suicide. You know,
your first.
That's what they call it. Well, I've done many of them, but I don't call it career suicide. I just call it dancing with the unknown and unpredictability. And it takes a lot of courage to do that, you know, mm-hmm. because some people say, well, you're going to lose your fans. I go, well, maybe they were never my fans then, you know, because if they're really my fans, they will accept me for my growth and not for who they want me to be.
That period of time in the record itself are well known among your fans and among the people who study music as a point where you started an inward spiritual journey, and some of the stuff that you were reading, taking cues from like what John Coltrane was doing with Eastern philosophies and stuff. How did you get turned on to all of that stuff that was happening and that marked those initial days of your path?
Just by being in San Francisco. San Francisco was the epicenter of everything. You know, you can hear Mongo Santa Maria or John Coltrane, Ravi Shankar, you know, the Grateful Dead, Jimi Hendrix, Tito Puente, Ray Barreto, you know. So to me, just being in San Francisco, it was natural, normal to play life instead of being a Latino that plays Latino rock. I don't see myself like that. That's too limiting for me.
So this was perhaps not your first exposure to like religion and spirituality. Growing up in a Mexican household, was religion an aspect of that experience? You mentioned your mommy here. Like, what was that like for you growing up? Was it present?
It was very natural and normal to convince my mom that I was done with the Catholic indoctrination, brain tattoo, mental slavery, you know, with the concept of sin. I was like, Mom, that doesn't make any sense to me since I was a child. So I'm going to look for other forms of how to connect with God, whether it's like through Buddha or Krishna or Allah or Rama. And I love Jesus, but he's not the only path for me, you know? Mm. I'm 75 years old. This is what I learned. There's a big difference between primitive Christianity and Christ consciousness. See, Christ consciousness is all-inclusive. Primitive Christianity is like, if you don't do it my way, you can go to hell. And I'm like, whoa, that's really spiritual of you. But see, there's a difference between religion and spirituality. Religion is Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola. It's a business, okay? It's a business of selling fear and division. Spirituality is like rainwater. It's pure. And everybody is worthy to be in the center of God's heart. That's why I gravitated to spirituality, and I was down with religion, because it's, to me, religion seemed like a, almost like a pimp kind of mentality, you know? Like they pimp you into, do it my way, you know? I'll protect you, you know, from, it's rough up there in the streets, but I'll protect you, but you got to work for me kind of thing, you know? And I'm like, no, I don't think Jesus would say that. I think you guys twisted what he said and who he is. And so, you know, a lot of people to this day, they see me as like an anti-this or anti-that. I'm not anti-Christ. Real Christ consciousness is all embracing. See, I say it like this. God created the world round so we can all have center stage. God created a circle of love so vast, no one can stand outside. So I have a different perception of it. When you embrace spirituality, the first thing that goes out the window is fear. You know, you dismiss it like polvo, like dust in your shoulders, like, get away from me, you know? My light, my spirit, and my soul are immutable, indestructible. I say this before many times, you know, you can look at the devil, Satan, and Lucifer in the eye and say, I got God's love. What do you got? And that immediately disappears like nothing that it is. The light is not afraid of shadows. And so immediately the music became more profound. You know, it's just that we have to present it like how you're doing it right now. When people read this interview or hear this interview and they say, oh, it makes sense to me now why his music is so universal and all-encompassing and appealing beyond time and gravity, you know?
Did you always feel that way? Did you always feel, you know, that sense of spirituality and that sense of, I guess, your rightness in your spirituality, your kind of like empowerment within it? Or was there a moment where that came to you?
It was always there, but I think that with the help of ayahuasca, peyote, LSD, it made it more easier, to say, primero soy espíritu, you know, y después lo que tú quieras. But I didn't come here to please pendejos, you know. I came here to really serve God, you know. And so my mom goes, why do you have to say it like that? You know, you were doing so good. And I'm like, because a lot of pendejos, if I don't do what they say, they get angry, you know. And I'm like, I can't live like that. I don't wake up to try to please people who they don't even know how to please themselves, because they're not that profound. They're deep as a spoon. They're shallow, hollow. And they want me to walk the way they walk. I don't think so. Do you want me to dress the way they dress? I don't think so. Like you, I am an individual, and I thank God for my uniqueness, individuality, and authenticity. That gives me a lot of courage and confidence.
We'll be right back to Alt Latino and our conversation with Santana.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Capital One Venture Card. Earn unlimited 2x miles on every purchase. Plus, earn unlimited 5x miles on hotels and rental cars booked through Capital One Travel. Your next trip is closer than you think with the Venture Card from Capital One. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
In this country, more than 2 local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
If you've never donated to the NPR network before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days, coming up on May 1st and 2nd. Please give at donate.npr.org, and thank you.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
We're back with Carlos Santana here on Alt Latino.
When I think about that era musically, and when you think about the last track you hear on the Santana 3, and then the opening sounds of Caravanserai with Mother Nature, with the crickets, and then Hadley Kellerman playing the saxophone, that's a major sound shift.
Well, yeah. First thing I says, I want to open up with crickets. Oh, crickets? Yeah, crickets. It's the sound of Mother Nature at night, serene, cooing you, like it's all good. Cricket, 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 you know. And we did it. When Michael and I embarked into this, we immediately became magnets, and we attracted Armando Peraza and Dougie Rauch and Hadley Kellerman, Richard Commode and Tom Costa, you know. So we were able to create the music we wanted to because we had the players. You know, this is the lesson that people can learn from what Santana is saying. Once you focus on the potency of your gratitude, then your attraction becomes really, really intense. Then you can attract the universe to give you what you want and more. So we were not afraid. You know, the greatest compliments that I got at that time came from Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea and Miles. Everybody were like, yeah, Santana, this is the direction, man. Because I constantly learn from them, but then they started learning from us as well, you know?
What did harnessing the potency of your gratitude mean for you at that time? I mean, that's like such an incredible set of words to use, and I'm really curious what you mean by that.
See, here in Las Vegas, I live here in Las Vegas, but I don't believe in luck or chance or fortune. You know, I believe in grace. And by grace, I'm able to focus. When you focus on something, you're increasing the potency of your attractions. The more you say gratitude, deep appreciation, and thankfulness, the more universe reads you and floods you with 100 times more what you got.
You've said that the Caravanserai was the first album that you needed to listen to from beginning to end, the way the tracks flow in and out of each other. What was the intention? What was the idea? Where did you guys get that idea from?
Well, the other albums like that were Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, probably Pink Floyd, Darker Side of the Moon, 2 or 3 albums from the Beatles. We call it a concept. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a novel. It's not just one song. Nowadays, people just do one song, and everything else is kind of like disposable. But when you listen to What's Going On, Marvin Gaye, the whole thing is outside of time, you know? So we wanted to create something like that, and we did it. I didn't care about the critics, what they were going to like stamp it and give it the approval. Like, I don't need permission or approval from anybody to do what my light tells me to do.
I feel like you listen to the record and it kind of feels like you're on a bit of like a hero's journey in a way. Like, I feel like the guitar is a bit of the main character and you're going on through all of these different waves of feelings and emotions. And I'm just curious because talking to you now, you sound so enlightened and you sound so assured and it feels like you know exactly where you're at spiritually and emotionally. And at the time, like, were you seeking in writing this album? Like, what were you searching for something, or were you just as confident then as you are now?
I was just as confident. And thank you for asking that. At that time, I identified more with being a seeker. I identify now with being a founder. I find anything that I want is right in front of me or inside me. So I don't have to seek anymore, you know. I just have to close my eyes and hear it and then play it. It's not outside of me. This is how I connected with my wife, Cindy. She prayed for me. I pray for her. This is the key words that people can understand from this whole interview. if you concentrate on your belief and your trust and belief, you're there. You know, that's enlightenment. That's like you have a deep awareness of your own light, your own divinity. For those people who say, well, only Jesus is divine, and I go, okay, that works for you. Go ahead. Try it out. But see, I can see Christ consciousness in everyone. So we all have the capacity to push that button in your heart, and voila, you receive an avalanche of abundance. For me, since the beginning, it's always been, since I was a child, my imagination is really powerful, you know, and it transcends what's in front of me. My imagination is more vibrant and stimulating than anything on any channel of television. Most people, they're just reading a cue card anyway, at the teleprompter. I don't get paid to read teleprompters, you know. I don't, you know. I read my heart, and I read my light, and that takes me further than whoever's writing whatever they're writing on the teleprompter for me to say. That gives me a different kind of a edge and freedom.
Are there any particular tracks that you remember fondly or that stand out to you from the album?
Song of the Wind. Neil and I, when we played Song of the Wind, I was living in Montalvo Pies in San Francisco in Mill Valley. I was driving and I would listen to the first rehearsal that we did, and I just started sobbing. I didn't even know why. I said, why am I crying, you know? Because it was the end of that Santana, you know?
The first version of the band.
Yeah, first version of the band. You know, it was over. There was no way to put it back together because Greg was on a journey to be with Journey, and so does Neil. And they didn't want to participate in the kind of music that Michael Shreve and I wanted to do. So I cried because it was time to say goodbye. There might be other moments when we get together and stuff, but this particular vision and mission is done.
Where do you put this record in your decades-long career? How do you consider this record?
It was a great love affair between the intangible and the tangible. It was the first love affair with going for something, especially when people tell you not to do it and you shouldn't do it, you know, the forbidden zone, you know, kind of thing. I don't look at any of the albums like this or that because they're all my children.
I was telling Felix as I was listening all the way through the other night, I was doing so on a run. And I was saying that I just felt so immediately dropped into like this mindfulness, just listening to it. I was like, oh, I just feel like I'm so centered and in this moment. And there's something so timeless, I think, about a record that can do that for you. But I also think that now in the world that we're living in presently, people are having a lot more conversations about spirituality and mindfulness and in relationship to that mental health and all of those things. Like, where do you see this record and what it does for people and the energy that it holds? Like, where do you see it sitting in today's world where we're more open about talking about these things?
It will always be an invitation to the best part of you, the part that is like you can't stain it. You can't burn it. You can't drown it. Again, immutable. There's a part of you that's immutable, indestructible. And we didn't know it then, but Michael Shreve and I, we were tapping on music that the Beatles were doing, kind of like, we were talking about the space, you know. And so George Harrison was doing it already, and so does Pharoah Sanders. You know, Coltrane, definitely. Later on, Bob Marley. It's interesting that we were playing songs in 1969 and 70 talking about Toussaint L'Ouverture and Incident of Nishapur, about a black revolutionary general that beat up Napoleon's army. You know, this is 1970.
In Haiti. He's a Haitian revolutionary.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure that Bob Marley knew us, you know, because Haiti is not that far from Kingston, Jamaica. We, like Bob Marley, gave birth to world music. And what is world music? It means todo está ahí, you know, Apache, Comanche, Cherokee, you know, Aborigine, river dance, and square dance, you know, all of it. It's just that revolvemos los huevos diferentemente, you know? Like, for example, when you listen to a polka, upa, 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 which is kind of like a lot of mariachi music like that. But if you listen to the way Jamaican people do it, it's called ska, the specials. Rudy, ka, 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 da, 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 da. You know, so I learned to embrace all of the music. This is how it started for me. I was living in San Francisco in the Mission, and they invited us to a una kermes in San Jose. It was some kind of picnic or something. And when I got out of the car, I heard three music at the same time from the park. Mariachi music, música tropical, because it wasn't called salsa yet, and rock and roll music. You know, I heard it, all of it at the same time, and I went, ah, okay, I see. And that, for me, became like a revelation that I can combine all the colors and it would work. You know, combine Tito Puente with B.B. King. That's what Black Magic Woman is. And Otis Rush and Wes Montgomery and Peter Green. We've been doing this for a while before we even knew what to call it. To me, what I do has never been a job or work. It's always been a gift. I can't believe I get paid to do what I love to do, you know? Which is like awesome, you know?
I know the feeling, bro.
Órale. Gracias, man.
What was most striking to me, honestly, was just like how unwavering he was in his confidence about all of these things. Like, he is, I think, by far the most self-assured artist we've ever spoken to, and that he was just like so sure of where he was at and his spirituality and the level of connection and almost like enlightenment that he had reached. And he didn't really point to a moment where he was lost or he was unsure, which I think is like a very rare thing. And I wonder if he has consistently been that way and felt that feeling, or maybe, you know, it's a tad bit of rewriting history at a certain point in your life, you know, where you forget about the uncertain moments.
Going back to his memoir and then some of the interviews that I've read, he has been consistent about that. I need to change my life. There's too much going on, too much excess, very much like Farruko talked about when we interviewed him. There's too much excess going on. I need to change my life, and the only way I'm going to do it is if I do this. My understanding of that history is that there was never any wavering, that this is exactly what he needed to do. So that made sense to me.
But in order to feel as though you have to make a change, there has to be a point, at least I think, where you felt differently. I don't know. I mean, what is there to change if you've been consistent your whole life?
Maybe it's just in terms of understanding that the life you're living is a dead end. And I think that might have to go along with what he was doing musically, because before those guys created it in those first three records, it didn't exist, right? That sound. There is a certain single-mindedness. There's a certain, like, I'm going to move forward on this and just see what's out there and just keep creating as a member of the band, as an individual. So there's already this sense of purpose, this like, I'm moving forward on this no matter what.
He's really a fascinating, not just musician, but really as an individual, he's a really interesting person.
And there's a parallel to how that comes out in his music. As you mentioned, you were swept up in the majesty or the mystique or the feelings or the feels, as you guys say these days, right? You were caught up in the feels of the album, the Caravanserai we were talking about. And there's a lot of that specifically in John Coltrane, because he was a seeker. He was seeking out Eastern philosophies, new ways of life, new ways of thinking, all of that stuff. And that came out in his music.
I think there's a direct parallel. It's one of the few artists that you could make that same connection, you know, in the world of pop music that's outside of jazz, in Santana's music.
That'll do it for this week's show. You have been listening to Alt Latino. Our editor is Hazel Sills.
Our audio editor is Ron Scalzo.
Our amazing PA is Fee O'Reilly.
And the person who keeps us all in control is Grace Chung.
And of course, as always, thanks to the big jefe, Keith Jenkins, VP of Music and Visuals.
I'm Felix Contreras.
I'm Ana Maria Sayer.
Thank you so much for listening.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Capital One Venture X Card. Earn unlimited 2X miles on everything you buy. Plus, get access to a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Every time you drive your car, have a package delivered, or get on a plane, you're polluting the climate. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Nature is powerful. Why don't we use it to our advantage?
Meet the people working on cleaner ways to get around on Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR. Transportation Climate Solutions on Here and Now Anytime, wherever you listen to podcasts.